in your work? If you shuffle to the supply room or the bathroom at a snail's pace, onlookers might mistakenly think you had nothing better to do, or draw the conclusion that you aren't interested in getting back to what you're being paid for. Little trick number two, the I know where I'm going gate. Don't take a chance that your boss will get the wrong idea because your pace is slow. Take long, brisk strides wherever you walk at work and look like you have a mission to accomplish. Keep your destination in mind and concentrate on what you will do when you get there. Look directed. Look determined. Look dynamic. Chapter 4. Big thinkers move big. When people tell you, you gotta think big, they're usually referring to inspiring concepts like visualizing impossible achievements or having no limits on your thinking. It's spot-on advice for anyone, and for a company owner or CEO, it can be a matter of the business's life or death. If a leader makes one damaging decision, the company can crash like a cracked glacier collapsing into the ocean. But wherever you are on the totem pole, thinking big is crucial. For the moment, however, I'd like to talk about another form of big, and that's the way your body moves. Big movements hint at big thoughts and complete confidence. Some years ago, a copywriter in a California advertising agency emailed me, wanting coaching and communication skills. However, Livia lived too far away for me to work with her. I always tell prospective clients my coaching can't be effective unless I work with them in person. Livia's entreaty, however, was so heartfelt and sensitively written that I wanted to do what I could to help her and invited her to phone me. When she called, her voice pleasantly surprised me. Unlike many people seeking coaching, her voice was full of vitality. She sounded like a top pro who really knew her stuff. This confused me. Why was she seeking help when her communication skills seemed excellent? She sounded vivacious, tactful, insightful, and she seemed to have all the right qualities for success. Yet, she told me, the creative director at the agency promoted copy editors who've been there less time than I have, and I truly believe their work isn't as inspired. Now I was curious and told her that if she ever came to New York, I'd like to have lunch with her at no charge. She had a business trip planned the following month, so we made a date. I arrived at the restaurant early and waited just inside. When I saw Livia, her professional attire impressed me, and she was even more attractive than her online picture. I greeted her with a warm handshake, but was disappointed to feel hers was limp. She took off her coat and, with small movements, gave it to the coat check person almost apologetically. Following me to the table, she seemed stiff and kept her hands folded neatly in her lap and her elbows close to her sides when reaching for her napkin. It seemed like she was trying to make herself as small as possible. Although her voice was as vibrant as it had been on the phone when speaking, she looked down at the tablecloth as though she was inspecting it. At one point, Livia rested one hand on the table with her palm facing down. Open palms suggest warmth and openness. Her posture was exceptional, but rigid. Stiff body positions suggest rigidity of thought. Her body leaned neither forward nor back. Leaning towards someone while speaking expresses interest and enthusiasm. Leaning back implies the opposite. Once or twice, Livia folded her arms across her chest as though she were cold, but the restaurant was well heated. Crossed arms can look defensive, even defiant. While talking, she occasionally rubbed one of her arms. This is a self-comforting motion, like caressing yourself when you're nervous. Another time when I was speaking, she touched her ear. This hints at not wanting to hear what's being said. I began to sense why Livia wasn't as respected as she deserved to be at work. No matter how effective people are in their jobs, organizations don't want them in a position of power if they come across as tentative or unsure of themselves. Unfortunately, with her small, hesitant gestures, Livia didn't look like leadership material. I now suspected why top management hadn't promoted her, because I too couldn't see her dynamically leading a team. Successful people, especially effective top leaders, use wide spread out gestures. They walk dead center through double doors, not to one side. They reach for things faster, not hesitantly, and use more massive movements than less self-assured employees. In other words, they use their entire personal space. What is personal space? You've seen kids blowing those sudsy bubbles out of wands. Well, imagine one of those invisible globes encapsulating you. Employees who are less confident crouch in the middle of theirs, trying to make themselves as small as possible, almost as though they don't want to be seen. But those who are sure of themselves fill their entire bubble to the max. Whether sitting or standing, they put themselves in a power position taking up the entire bubble they own. This instinct comes naturally to all primates. When a gorilla strives to show he's king of the jungle, he stands upright, making himself taller. He widens his shoulders, thrusts his chest, and spreads his legs as if to say, "Look at me! Me big, me powerful, me strong." He might even beat his chest and follow it with a blood-curdling bellow. Fortunately, human beings aren't that obvious. Well, most of them at least. Noticeable changes do, however, take place in every employee's body when he or she feels powerful, capable, and confident. Everything expands. How can you train yourself to make bigger movements second nature? Like any physical habit, it's a matter of consciousness and practice. As far-fetched as it sounds, the following technique works. Little trick number 3. Make your bubble bigger. As soon as you get out of bed in the morning, stand up straight, clasp and interlock both hands over your head, and stretch your body to the right and to the left. Then extend your arms to their full length and swing them around in big circles. Roll your hips, kick your legs, and punch the air. Feel every inch of the big invisible bubble surrounding you and know it's all yours. Taking up more personal space puts you in a confident mindset to meet the rest of your challenges that day. Doing this drill just once in the morning, however, isn't enough. Find a place at work where no one can see you, perhaps an empty office or hallway, the supply room, or outdoors behind the building. I especially suggest this exercise before attending a significant meeting, having a performance review, meeting a new customer, or confronting any stressful situation. I do it before every speech I give, even though sometimes the only private space I can find at the venue is a bathroom stall. Think of it as a warm-up for success. Calculate your coworker's confidence. Having met and subsequently worked with thousands of people, I've learned to spot their confidence or lack thereof right off the bat. My antenna now picks up on how self-assured an individual is. You may not have considered it before, but you'd be surprised how much clout it gives you to know your colleagues' and bosses' confidence level. That sensitivity will help guide your strategy in subsequent interactions. For instance, you'll deal quite differently with someone who has small ideas and a big ego versus someone who has big ideas and a small ego. Also, gauging your boss's self-assurance level helps you handle her more strategically. Evaluating everyone's confidence is yet another instrument to add to your communication skills toolkit. When you watch how your colleagues move, you'll probably spot lack of self-assurance all around you, which should give you more. Chapter 5. You are so much more than your job description. Let me ask you a question that I'm sure you've been asked hundreds of times. What do you do? Before answering that, stop. I hope you weren't just going to give me your job title. You are so much more than that and far exceed what the company has decreed should be on your business card. People usually think of networking as something they do outside their job, particularly when looking for a new one or meeting other professionals in the same field. However, I haven't often heard employees talking about networking inside their own companies, which is just as vital to success. While chatting with someone you haven't met at the company's holiday party, delivering an envelope to a different department, or talking with an employee you don't know in the elevator, the person will no doubt ask, "What do you do here?" It's the common question I ask people at the various companies where I consult. At one of them, spotting an employee sitting alone in the lunchroom, I asked if I could join her. "Of course," she answered graciously. "Please do." I then asked her what she did there. The young lady smiled and said, "I'm just the receptionist." I wanted to shake her. Why did she demean herself by saying just? Did she really think her job was that unimportant? Didn't she realize that she was the first person that people saw the moment they entered the company? In a sense, she was the gateway to the organization. She was probably hired because of the same type of friendliness she displayed to me. It's a special quality, and the poor girl actually saw her crucial position as insignificant. "No, you are not just the receptionist," I gently chided her with a smile. "You are the receptionist." After a nervous laugh, she looked at me as though I were a little strange. Saying I'm just the anything is self-deprecating and makes you sound like you're embarrassed by your job. How much more impressive the receptionist would have been if she'd enthusiastically fleshed out her job description and perhaps told me some of her duties. Networking is an inside job, too. Talking about your job in an upbeat manner makes you more memorable inside your company if other opportunities crop up. Think of it as the elevator speech that all top professionals give, a brief description or commercial about what they do. Get your name around inside your organization. Don't just give your official title when coworkers you don't know ask what you do there. You perform certain duties at your company that enhance the bottom line, otherwise you wouldn't be there. Tell them about those. Just saying office manager, assistant sales manager, or travel coordinator isn't memorable. Say more. Depending on how familiar the person is with your department, flesh it out for them. For example, instead of presenting a confining job title like office manager, try something like, "I liaise with staff and suppliers, handle purchasing, and attend meetings with senior management," and sound excited about it. Instead of saying, "I'm the assistant sales manager," how about, "I help construct the sales plans, set quotas, and analyze data for the sales department." Rather than, "I'm the travel coordinator," say, "I make domestic and international transportation and lodging arrangements for the entire company." Be sure to talk about whatever you do with gusto and vitality, because expressing enthusiasm about your work is vital for professional success. Little trick number 4, your in-house elevator speech. Starting today, put meeting coworkers in other departments on your daily to-do list. When people you haven't met in the company ask what you do, give them a short description and sound upbeat. Sure, you can include your official title, but make that just a part of the answer, maybe at the end. When departments are discussing promotions and who they can nab from other departments, you want your name to come to mind. Chapter 6. What's your on-the-job face? Whether you've been top dog at your company for 20 years or are the new pup who started yesterday, this seldom discussed little trick makes you look confident and in control, even when you think no one is watching. Few employees ever think about it, but just like you have a resting heart rate, you have a resting facial expression. Some workers' lips naturally curve up at the edges, and those blessed with that upward tilt look more approachable and at peace with themselves. Other people's lips curve slightly down, which, unfortunately, can give off an unintended impression of unrest or irritation. You could be the warmest, most tranquil person in the company, but if God gave you downward-tilting lips, your coworkers might see you as otherwise. Most babies aren't born with tightened lips or a grumpy expression, but it can result from a rough childhood or years of negative experiences. The good news is that a troubled or insecure expression needn't be permanent. It just means those folks must consciously work on changing it. If you're on the job right now, look around at your coworkers, and you'll see the tips of everyone's lips curl slightly up or down. If you're curious about your resting facial expression, take a mirror, close your eyes, and push all thoughts out of your head. Now open them quickly and look at your lips. If the corners of your mouth slope slightly up, you are one of the lucky minority. I know it sounds touchy-feely, but I sometimes tell students in my classes to close their eyes and picture someone they love. Or perhaps think about their pet or favorite vacation place. Even an activity they look forward to or any private thought that gives them pleasure. While they have their eyes closed, I scan the crowd. During those moments, I see a remarkable change slowly sweep over their faces. Tension, aloofness, and nervousness fade. Serenity replaces it. I now feel I'm looking at a confident and content group of people. As I said, some are fortunate to be born with that calm, cheerful look on their faces at rest, and others must work at it, like I did. After consciously using the following little trick for about a month, I found that a pleasant expression is now habitual. This peaceful look improves how everyone responds to you at work. Little trick number 5, the serenity semi-smile. When you're not directly communicating with each other, which is more than 90% of the time, coworkers still get an impression of you. Make an effort to softly lift the corners of your mouth, even when you think no one is looking your way. It's not really a smile, just a serene and peaceful expression. You might put a reminder on your desk. Photos of your kids or a loved one would be a good choice to give you that sliver of a smile. But hey, whatever works for you. An additional self-check is to feel whether your shoulders are tight or perhaps pulled slightly up toward your ears. If so, relax them because that's another sign of tension. Now let's talk about the most important indicator of your confidence or lack of it. The following is like a 24-hour broadcasting station showing anyone within eyeshot precisely how you feel about yourself at any particular moment. Chapter 7. Your biggest confidence barometer. Imagine yourself all alone at home in front of the TV while the winning lottery numbers are being announced. The first two numbers sound like they might be yours, so your ears perk up. You scramble through your pockets to confirm it. They are. And OMG, the next few are yours too. By now, the wrinkled receipt clutched in your sweaty hands is soaked. And when the final number is called, you realize you've won the lottery. Your head jolts up and your shoulders shoot back without your even thinking about it. Your entire body radiates energy because you are a winner. Now there's a spring in your step, vitality in your eyes, and a soft smile frames your lips for the rest of the week. Your body language screams success. That's the image you want at work. Over the years, friends and family have taken hundreds of snapshots of you on their phones. In most of them, you're smiling and standing tall, because you're usually enjoying yourself. Your brow isn't furrowed. Your shoulders aren't hunched, and you don't look worried or anxious. But what does your body broadcast about you at work? If someone secretly snapped a shot of you sitting at your desk dealing with a customer or having a coffee in the break room, what would the photo show? Do you look like a winner? Or would the lens find you slumped over papers at your desk, slouched at the counter, or leaning against the wall? Perhaps it was just for a few minutes, but it only takes a split second for anyone looking your way to form an impression. You may seldom be in those positions, but suppose your boss happened to walk by at an ill-timed moment. Spotting you like that enough times could give the impression you're a sluggish worker. Good posture is vital to your image, which in turn stimulates confidence. Harvard University and Columbia University researchers proved the symbiotic relationship in a study called Do Slumped and Upright Postures Affect Stress Responses? They first told 26 women and 16 men to spit into a test tube for saliva samples and then directed them to sit in slouched positions. Hold your elbows close to your body, Drop your head and hold a scrunched-up position for 2 full minutes. At that point, they took a second saliva sample. After squirreling the samples away, the researchers instructed the subjects to now stand up straight, throw their heads back, thrust their chests out, rest their shoulders, and take up a lot of space for the next 2 minutes. Afterward, another saliva sample. The results? The researchers discovered a dramatic difference in the subjects' testosterone and cortisone levels. After sitting in upright positions, their testosterone, the hormone that signifies feeling strong and more willing to take risks in both females and males, shot up, and their cortisol, the hormone that makes us susceptible to stress, shrank. Conversely, after the low-power pose, the subject's cortisol level jumped and their testosterone took a 5-point nosedive. It's proof that excellent posture doesn't just make you look better. You feel more confident, think more clearly, and make better judgments. So how do you make perfect posture natural? No, it's not by going to the gym twice a week, although that helps, or balancing a book on your head. To make it your natural position, you must practice it a lot. That means while walking down the hall, sitting at your computer, or chatting with colleagues. It means when driving the car, having dinner with the family, or enjoying a beer with friends. Perfect alignment must become second nature so you don't even need to think about it. But to achieve that, you need a constant reminder. Unfortunately, you can't hire a physical trainer to follow you around at work. Here's a solution. Think of something you normally do many times each day and make that your cue. For instance, you're constantly walking through doorways, morning, afternoon, and night. You enter and leave your company building and go through dozens of office doors daily. You enter and exit the restroom, the break room, and places where you eat. At home, there's the front door, kitchen door, living room door, bedroom door, and more. One day, I decided to count how many doors I walked through. It came to 50. And I bet many of you busy folks top that. Little trick number 6. Doorway to confidence. Let every door you walk through remind you to lift your head higher, as though you wanted your hair to brush the top of the doorway, and throw out your chest, as though you wanted it to go through first. This technique is especially important entering the conference room, your boss's office, and everywhere else you want to make a great impression. Turn every doorway into your free physical trainer nudging you to stand taller. Before long, it becomes natural to look like a winner at all times. Chapter 8. A crafty way to calculate their confidence and convince them of yours. On your way to the top, it's important to know how sure of themselves the people you work with are so you can deal with them more effectively. This next little trick gives you rare insight into that. You've fed pigeons in the park, right? After tossing a few breadcrumbs on the ground, hungry little birds magically appear from nowhere and apprehensively land about 10 feet away. In time, one brave bird bolts at a crumb, grabs it in his beak, and makes a quick getaway. His fellow pigeons, pleased to see their bold feathered friend survived, follow suit and scurry toward the crumbs. As they become confident that you won't hurt them, they come even closer, and soon you're surrounded by a flock of pigeons. Human beings have pigeon instincts too. When a coworker feels confident and comfortable with you, let's just say she feels safe, she'll move physically closer. But if she feels inferior or harbors negative feelings toward you, she'll stand farther away. You unconsciously do the same. Say you're a woman talking to another woman with whom you've been working a long time. As the conversation develops, you instinctively come closer because you feel comfortable with her. If you also happen to be friends outside the office, you move even nearer. Conversely, if you find her intimidating, you step back without even thinking about it. Distance reveals a lot. A meek employee might tap lightly on the boss's door, take a few tentative steps into that scary territory, and ask a question hovering close to the door. But your boss might march into your space and come right up to your desk. Here's where the science of human distances called proxemics comes into play. The good news is that you can learn this subtle skill of maintaining strategic distances to project the image you want. The specifics vary by culture, but for North America, I turn to anthropologist Edward Hall, who divided the measurements into intimate distance, personal distance, social distance, and public distance. Unfortunately, knowing his calculations in feet and inches isn't practical for me. I just can't wrap my head around gauging distances in space. And I'm not about to take out a tape measure, put one end on the tip of a colleague's nose, and pull the other back to mine. So let me share my method with you, because insight into workplace relationship subtleties gives you a big advantage. Imagine yourself standing and speaking with a colleague, and you both put your arms straight out in front of you. If the tips of your middle fingers are still inches apart, it might indicate one of you finds the other intimidating or there's antagonism. I call this the no fingertip touch. To express more warm confidence, step forward so the palms of your hands can lie flat against each other's. I label this the full palm press. To appear completely confident, casual, and comfortable with someone, envision both of you with arms straight forward, grasping each other's wrists or even forearms. Gentlemen, since it's natural for you to stand farther away from another man, you might find this wrist or forearm grasp a little creepy. Follow your instincts, and to be on the safe side, put the same distance between you and a female colleague as you would if you were talking to another man. If she steps closer, that's her choice. But beware, it could send the wrong message to onlookers. There's a final distance category, but it's way too close for comfort at work. I call that the nose-tip touch, where your finger can touch the tip of your colleague's nose. No matter how friendly you two are, avoid this one on the job. Proxemics may sound like minutiae or even plain nonsense to you, but I promise the distance between you signals a lot. Little trick number 7. Come confidently closer. Shrinking your distance from someone shows you feel sure of yourself. Stepping closer is an excellent way to mask insecurity or hostility, so anytime anyone at work intimidates or irritates you, just smile slightly and step a tad closer. They'll never know you're afraid or angry. However, here is a big don't. If a coworker adjusts the distance between you by moving back, do not step closer, because that's encroaching on her space. And of course, if she steps nearer to you, hold your ground. That's her comfort zone. Everyone's is different. In business, it's not only strategic to gauge a colleague's confidence level. It also helps to know his opinion on your ideas, even if he's silent. His distance choice is a clue to both. Emma, a supervisor in one of my classes, said that after giving her team members an assignment, she watches carefully to determine if their heads inch subconsciously toward her or away. Knowing how they feel about a certain situation, she said, helps me work with various employees throughout the project. The following tip helps determine how your coworkers feel about you and what you're saying at the moment. This knowledge can be important in your future interactions with them. Little trick number 8. Examine their distance choice. If you want to know a coworker's sentiments about you or your words, take note of that individual's habitual stance when talking with others. Then compare it with how close he or she chooses to be to you. Believe it or not, being sensitive to nuances like this will help you circumvent negative workplace relationships. Chapter 9. How to Sound Self-Assured in Email and IM. Since so much communication, the majority of it in many companies, is email and instant messaging, let's talk about coming across as confident in writing, too. Unfortunately, impressive entrances, walking energetically, making larger movements, maintaining a peaceful, self-assured expression, standing or sitting tall, and coming a tad closer don't work in writing. So how do you sound more confident in your email? For the answer, Let's go back to a kid's game many of us played in our coloring books called What's Wrong with This Picture? You may remember it. You'd find funny drawings of stuff, like a farm with animals grazing, a tractor, a couple of flags to show the directions of the wind, and lots more. Most of the objects in the sketch looked normal, but the instructions told you to circle any mistakes. So you dutifully took a big crayon out of the box and got to work. You were a keen-eyed kid, and you saw the tractor had only three wheels. Great, you circled it. You searched around a little more, and then, aha, there were two flags blowing in opposite directions. You circled those, too. Now you were on a roll. You also marked the dog, who had a cat's head, and the barefoot kid with six toes, and lots more wrong stuff. Now let's play a grown-up version of What's Wrong with This Picture, called What's Wrong with This Sentence. Don't worry, I haven't cracked up. It leads to a technique to make you sound more confident online. Here are some sentences that people have emailed me. Mark any of them in which the senders sound less sure of themselves. Serena wrote, I wanted to know if the conference is still scheduled. Tomas wrote, I'll try to get it done today. Clarissa wrote, I think we should send it to the client next week. Mackenzie wrote, I'm sorry I can't make the meeting today. Would tomorrow work for you? Judah wrote, I just want to ask if you received it. Which sentences made the writer sound insecure? I'm sure you've guessed the answer. All of them. Why? Their messages included what I call weakening words. Serena, don't you still want to know if the conference is on schedule? Putting your desires in the past tense is one of the most prevalent examples of humble writing. Far too often, people have sent me self-deprecating sentences like, I was hoping you would have time to talk about it, or I wanted to ask your opinion. Putting your desires in the past makes you sound like you're embarrassed about them. Put your wishes in the fearless present, which confidently says what you mean. Here's what I want now. Tomas, the word try always sounds weak, like you're not sure you can accomplish what you want to do. I will get it done this week, barring any big obstacles, shows you have more assurance in your abilities. Clarissa, you think we should send it to the client next week? You'd sound stronger saying, my suggestion is, or my position is. Mackenzie, why are you apologizing? You're not doing anything wrong. Simply write, I regret I can't make the meeting today, and then ask about your recipient's availability tomorrow. Judah, of course you want to know if the person you're writing to received the order, and you have every right to know. Just ask, have you received the order? You'll sound surer of yourself. The list of weak phrases to drop goes on. This is just a thought, or just a question. Sorry to bother you. I might. I can't. Sort of. I'm wondering if... Well, you get the idea. Substitute all of them with something stronger. Little trick number 9. Avoid weakening words. Avoid common phrases like, I'll try, I think, I just, and the others we talked about. Also, steer clear of the self-belittling, much-overused past tense for something you still want or feel. Above all, there's no need to say I'm sorry when you're not guilty of anything. We women do that far too often. Chapter 10. Can you look too confident? As I reflect on the hundreds of speeches and seminars I've given over the years, several stand out for different reasons. I especially remember this next one because of the amazing audience. A few years ago, Martin, the head of a speaker's bureau I often work with, called saying the Young President's Organization, YPO, a prestigious group of men and women who became presidents of their companies before the age of 45, wanted me to give a breakout session at its next annual conference. I was thrilled, because fellow speakers had told me YPO members were an inspiring group. I called the bureau the next day to learn more about what they wanted. Martin said they'd asked for my most popular presentation, How to Talk to Anyone. You're kidding, I laughed. What could I possibly teach these accomplished folks about communicating? If they've become presidents or CEOs of their companies so young, they must already be super communicators. What can I say, Leal? Their meeting planner asked for it. Shall I accept for you or not? Yes, absolutely. Are there any particulars they want me to concentrate on? They specifically asked for tips on body language. He answered. What? I gasped. That's what they told me. I guess that means they want to know how to look even more presidential. Ha ha ha, I smirked. No, I'm dead serious. Then, grasping at straws, I said, well, maybe some of them want it because they inherited the company, married into it, or were somehow related to the founders. Martin shrugged. Incidentally, I discovered I was dead wrong about that. With few exceptions, YPO members had reached their heights the old-fashioned way, earning it through hard work, making the right decisions, and looking like a leader. The day before my presentation, I flew to Colorado Springs. As I entered the huge hotel lobby, attendees were having lively chats with one another as they were signing in. Glancing around the group, it struck me how statesmanlike and completely sure of themselves they all looked. Riding up in the elevator to my room, I felt like a 10-year-old hired to teach brain surgeons how to perform a craniotomy and feared whoever booked me would get canned from the speaker search committee. The organizer had scheduled my session for 9 a.m. the next day. Well, that's good, I figured, because most of them will be sleeping in after their long trips and the welcome party that went on past midnight. No such luck. At 9 a.m. sharp, the room was packed with a crowd of about 60 men and women looking very presidential indeed. I was thoroughly convinced my content would be too basic and pictured them walking out the door, one by one or in small groups, leaving me stranded in a huge empty room. The surprise ending. Much to my surprise, my presentation became the most talked about session of the weekend. I opened by commending them on their commanding look of leadership. Then it was sheer dumb luck that I happened to joke. What could I possibly teach you? At that, one attendee cupped his hands around his lips and called out, "How to tone it down!" They all laughed. But he was dead serious. That's what they wanted. When I asked why, several told me they'd been accused of having a superior attitude at their companies. One said he'd heard his employees thought he was insensitive. Another said she was accused of being inattentive. Now I got really psyched and turned my planned presentation into an open discussion. One president in the audience explained that the members were well aware of this problem in previous years and had booked presentations on what leaders could say to employees to sound friendlier. But apparently various complaints at their companies continued. That year, the member responsible for finding a speaker was a woman who had another theory. Being familiar with her colleagues at YPO, she suspected their physical demeanor might be the problem, so she asked the Bureau for a body language speaker. At that moment, I retroactively forgave Martin for not having understood his client's needs better. It wasn't his fault, because it certainly was a one-of-a-kind request. No meeting planner had ever asked for a program on how to not look so sure of yourself. As the presidents offered their testimonies, the cacophony of complaints about bosses in my seminars resounded in my ears. I told the group what many of my students had grumbled. My boss points her finger right at me when accusing me of something. Mine squints at me like he doesn't believe a word I'm saying. When I'm talking to him, he crosses his arms in front of his chest. She stands with her hands on her hips and gives me directions. He turns away when I'm trying to explain something to him. I saw a few sheepish smiles around the room as I mentioned various complaints. A few even playfully mumbled, "Guilty." At that point, I also spotted a couple of confused expressions. One woman had been nervously rubbing the back of her neck and stroking her forearm. Since the session had become more of an open discussion than a presentation, I asked her thoughts on the subject. She looked around and said, Well, as some of you know, my company is a family business, which I took over when my dad died last year. I know the field inside out, having grown up with it, but I never felt secure being in this leadership position. So I guess sometimes I overdo it. Several other young presidents in the room nodded empathetically. I sensed she wasn't the only one who used bold gestures to cover up a basic insecurity. She noticed there was a pad of paper on an easel in the room and offered to write down some of the arrogant gestures we'd been discussing. And as I handed her the magic marker, the others clapped. The session was lively, to say the least. By the end, she'd written 6 full pages of employee complaints. It was an unforgettable afternoon for me. After the session, I snatched the sheets off the pad, took them up to my room, and packed them in my suitcase. Here are some selections from those sheets. My boss leans back and crosses his arms when I'm talking like I'm a nobody. She walks right past me when she sees me in the hall. He doodles on his pad when I'm making a presentation in a meeting. She hangs over my desk like she's so superior. When I'm trying to tell him something, he sometimes puts his feet up on the desk. While I'm talking to her in her office, she looks at her computer every time she hears a new email coming in. He leans back and puts his arms behind his head with his elbows jutting out. She waves her finger like a metronome when she disagrees with what I've said. He leans over my desk, putting his palms down on it, and stares at me. She puts her chin in the air and looks down her nose at me. Gestures that shout, "I'm better than you." We saw that the list on the easel fell into 3 categories. Acting superior. Putting their hands on their hips, leaning back with arms behind their head, putting feet up on their desks, and steepling their hands. Disinterest. Not making eye contact, looking bored, or not listening. Rejection. Folding their arms, rolling their eyes, or turning away while being talked to. Little trick number 10. Stamp out superiority signals. Always look in command and self-assured at work, but avoid thoughtless, overbearing gestures. Coming off as too cocksure of yourself can obstruct your climb up the ladder because employees resent those who act like they're better than everyone else. Now let's talk about an equally important quality for professional success and happiness. It's caring about the people you work with, which sadly seems missing in many companies today. I'm sure you've heard the axiom, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Truer words were never spoken, and we'll tackle that now. Part 2. Caring. Chapter 11. Treat their ego like eggshells. Hemophiliacs are people who bleed profusely when their skin is pricked. Everyone you work with has a comparable condition, but this one has nothing to do with blood or skin. They bleed emotionally when anyone punctures their ego. Let's call these folks egophiliacs. Are they bad people? No, it simply means they're human. Deep inside everyone is a big baby rattling the crib, wanting attention and screaming to be recognized as special. Each is, in his or her own way, you know. Everyone brings a distinct set of life experiences to work, and each has a different self-image. What exactly is ego? In the simplest terms, it's the narrative people create about themselves. It's who they've spent every hour of every day of their lives becoming. And so protecting their egos is, in a sense, a matter of survival. People's egos are as delicate as eggshells. You must have the talent of a blind ballet dancer prancing on a stage strewn with these fragile shells and not breaking even one. As you grow in your company, you'll have to make clear and decisive judgment calls for the betterment of your organization. But to be a true success, you must do it without destroying the dignity and pride of the people you work with. Often, employees won't like it when you stay firm on an unpopular stance. You must correct poor performance, Say no when asked for something and sometimes fire people you personally like. Those are just a few of the stairs you'll climb on the way to the top. But if you develop the professional dexterity to achieve those goals while making people feel good about themselves and their capabilities, you've really made it and deserve to be at the top. Now let's talk about how to do that, and we'll start with your smile. Chapter 12. Is the sincere smile an oxymoron at work? People smile at work, sometimes even sincerely. I'm sure you've seen many other types of smiles around the office, too. Smiles of surrender, smiles of deception, phony smiles, lecherous smiles, and those that are just plain ludicrous. When the big boss tells a joke, I've seen employees force grins so big they look like monkeys on a banana boat. Don't people realize a smile is a lot more than flashing teeth, parting lips, and saying cheese? Wouldn't it be wonderful to work in a company where you didn't have to fake a smile, or for that matter, any emotions you don't feel? A company where you didn't have to pretend you thought your colleague's presentation was great, or you really cared about a coworker's weekend plans. But in the hundreds of organizations I've worked with, I've yet to discover even one where employees don't sometimes need to fake smiles. Often, you don't think something's funny or agree with what somebody's saying. But for tactical or humane reasons, you must pretend that you do. You should also learn to recognize when your colleague's smiles are bogus, because without that ability, you might make wrong choices and big mistakes. No doubt you've heard that a real smile reaches the eyes. When someone genuinely agrees with you, chuckles at something witty you've said, or just appreciates your ideas, you see it in the person's eyes. Or, more accurately, you see it just beside their eyes, in the little wrinkles around them. They're called your orbicularis oculi. You really needed to know that, didn't you? Great, you might figure. So I'll just crinkle my eyes when I'm smiling at someone. Not so fast. That's impossible, because orbicularis oculi are involuntary muscles that you can't crinkle at will. Sincere smiles will eventually give you crow's feet, but they're well worth it. Another huge difference between genuine and counterfeit smiles concerns the speed. When you're faking a smile, your lips jolt instantly up and you quickly flash your teeth. However, when you truly do appreciate what you're hearing or find something funny, it takes longer for the meaning of the words to sink in. Thoughtful and truthful people smile slightly more slowly because they're not faking it. They need a moment to understand what you're saying, and only then do their smiles erupt naturally. So here's the secret to making yours sincere. Little trick number 11. The slow spillover smile. Don't smile too fast. Make it just as large, but slow it down. Listen carefully to what the speaker is saying, then let a smile envelop your face and engulf the recipient like a warm wave. Think of it starting in your heart, traveling to your brain, and finally making it to your lips. We're talking milliseconds here, but it makes a huge difference. People who smile too fast look fake, and that's worse than not smiling at all. The next little trick is for women only. Men, you can skim, but don't forget to read the last two sentences in the paragraph that follows the technique, because that tip is for you. Women, a quick smile and a slow jet get you nowhere fast. Have you heard of Confederate dollars? History buffs, you'll know the newly formed Confederacy issued them just before the outbreak of the American Civil War, but because the dollars weren't backed by anything, the value quickly dropped to a nickel or below. Likewise, sisters, if you smile too often, as many women do, the value of your smiles drops drastically. We, of the erroneously called gentle sex, have used smiles all our lives to great advantage. Sitting on Daddy's lap when we were little, we knew that an adorable grin often got us what we wanted. Then during our teens, we discovered smiling at a guy was a great way to lure him over. And even now, when we get together with girlfriends socially, it's smiles galore. Why not? They're fun. At work, however, you have different priorities. Your corporate colleagues, especially males, might misinterpret your smiles and misconstrue them as weakness or even flirting. Even if you are the strongest, most proficient person in the company, don't depend on smiles to get you what you want like they did with Daddy. The success of the withheld smile. Several years ago, an association of engineers hired me to give a series of communication skills presentations to their members. The vice president, Florence, with whom I'd previously had only email contact, invited me to meet with her managers one morning, all males. When I arrived, Florence, a stately, subdued woman, stood up and graciously extended her hand, saying, "It's nice to see you, Lily." Lily? How strange. That was my nickname in high school, which I promptly dropped on graduation day. It didn't sound like the serious professional woman I aspire to be. Oh well, I figured. It must have been a slip of the tongue. But then things got even stranger. Once during the meeting, this highly professional woman winked at me. Weird. Especially because she'd acted quite commanding throughout the discussions. I tried to push her wink out of my mind while we continued talking about my upcoming presentation. As the men were leaving the conference room, Florence said, "Lily, can you stay for a minute?" She then closed the door and giggled. I was dumbfounded because giggling was not this woman's style. Her face exploded into a wide, warm smile, and she held out her arms for a hug. Holy cow, what is this all about? Only then did it dawn on me. I finally recognized Florence. She was from my high school. Except then she was called Flossie. Her quicksilver smile and contagious laugh were legendary in school, and it endeared her to everyone. Flossie was an incurable giggler, and that was part of her charm. Flabbergasted, I said, "Oh my gosh, Flossie, is that you?" "Yes, Lily, it's so good to see you," she squealed, giving me a hug. "If you're free, can we have lunch today?" "Absolutely. We have so much to catch up on." What I most wanted to catch up on was why Florence seemed so super professional at the office, and then the moment her colleagues left, she reverted to the old effervescent Flossie. Halfway through lunch, and emboldened by a glass of wine, I asked my burning question. "Florence, you seem so different at the office." She laughed gleefully, saying, "Oh, Lily, just call me Flossie, and there's no need to ask why I seem different. I'm not. It's just that I don't smile all the time like I used to." Her face then got serious, and she went on to explain. "Actually, the only thing that's changed is how quickly I smile or laugh. At my old job, people far junior to me were getting promoted, and I wasn't. Because engineering is a male-dominated industry, I suspected my gender was keeping me back. So I did some research on gender differences and came across tons of studies talking about how women smile much more often than men, and how that can sometimes undermine our seriousness." "So, did you stop smiling?" "Heavens no," she chuckled, feigning shock. "I just changed how often I smile. Now there's a world of difference in how people at work respond to me, especially men. When I enjoy something or find it funny, of course I smile. But when I'm in a business setting, I'm a little more stingy with them. And if I don't approve of something, I don't fake one like I used to. I guess I did that when I was younger because I desperately wanted to be liked." Flossie and I then talked about the renowned anthropologist Helen Fisher's extensive studies on human nature, saying that many males often view a woman smiling as subservient, weak, and vulnerable. We laughed about how, when we were in school, men passing us on the street would sometimes say, "Hey, young lady, smile." If they said that to a man, they'd get slugged. I, too, had read the research and realized she had done the right thing. The proof is she'd worked her way up to vice president at her new job in a predominantly male company. No quick smiles were holding Flossie back. Nor was her nickname, which she dropped in favor of her birth name, Florence. Too many smiles lose their value. Ladies, I suggest this modification of your smile policy. Little trick number 12. Smile amendment for women. Especially those of you who are surrounded by men on the job, avoid your instinct of smiling too soon, too big, too often. Doling out lots of fast smiles doesn't enhance your image as a top professional. Save your lovely quick smiles for your friends, family, and the kids. However, I'd like to add an important note for female supervisors. If you're the boss, you can be more generous with your smiles when working with reports, and it will pay off in your team's productivity big time. And gentlemen, let your fellow employees and reports, especially the women, witness more of them. A man with a big, warm, sincere smile is a joy to work with. Sometimes a speedy smile is essential. While I was sounding off on the slow spillover smile and smile amendment, I hope you didn't think I was disparaging the very significant quick smile. Every smile doesn't have to be a reality show. In fact, in certain professions, such as customer service, a quick smile is crucial. How many times has a gas station attendant, grocery clerk, or hotel receptionist handed you a receipt with a deadpan expression? At times, I've had to bite my tongue to keep myself from blurting out, "Hey, buddy, would a smile really crack your face?" Customer service without a smile is customer disservice. The president of a small retail bank for which I consult was concerned about an unusually high number of customers transferring their accounts to other institutions. He told me that they'd been getting complaints about the tellers. "I don't understand it, Leal," he said. "Our tellers are highly trained and are extremely competent." The aggrieved man sounded like he was at his wit's end over it. I started my detective work by opening a small account at his bank. I went there to deposit money or cash a check at their busiest time, lunch hour, to spy on the tellers while I was waiting in line. The same scene unfolded over and over. Customers approached the tellers who did their job as they were trained, checking figures, counting cash, filling in forms, and doing everything according to bank standards. To me, at least, the problem was obvious. The only thing the tellers lacked was a simple, welcoming smile for each customer. When finished with one client, they'd call out, "Next," sometimes without even looking up. When it was my turn, I'd make eye contact, smile, and say, "Good morning," to which my teller would respond with a flat, "Good morning," and answer my questions with a deadpan face. Standing at the counter, looking to both the right and left, I saw that other customers' transactions seemed to be going smoothly, too. But I didn't spot a smile on any of the tellers' or the clients' faces. At the end of each transaction, I'd hear the tellers mumble, "Have a nice day," as though it were a death threat. After repeating this experience for the next few days with a different teller, I saw that the bank's problem was endemic. Together with the supervisors, so they could monitor their reports, I gave the tellers what we jokingly referred to as smile training. As hackneyed as it sounds, it worked. Far fewer customer complaints came in after our smile training sessions, and the bank looked like a much happier place to be for both tellers and customers. Little trick number 13. Quick smiles count too. Especially in customer service. Sometimes there's no time or no need for you to give the slow spillover smile. For these occasions, a quick welcoming one at the beginning, a few occasional ones during, and a goodbye smile at the end of a short encounter make a world of difference. There's something in it for you, too. Customers and colleagues you barely know will treat you much better. Chapter 13. Track them with your torso. Due to bitter bickering over vacation schedules at Burns and Company, a supervisor threw up her hands in exasperation and told her direct reports that this year she was just going to assign vacations. When she called the members of her team together around the conference table to announce her decisions, they were all anxious. They immediately turned full body toward her, breathlessly awaiting their holiday fate. Kelsey, you have December 15th through January 1st. Hooray, Kelsey exclaims to herself, and her imagination lights up with visions of the sparkling Christmas tree she's planning. Her body leans forward toward the bearer of good news. Bless you, she's thinking.